Hello, this is the On Science podcast from NPR, the weekly roundup of coverage from the Science Desk. I'm Andrew Prince. This week, we're going to bring you a couple of new research stories. Scientists studying the aftermath of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico have found that almost all of the methane gas released from the oil well has been eaten by bacteria. We've also got surprising news about chemical signaling from human tears. And we'll go deep underground at the Large Hadron Collider and bring you updates on some of the work going on there. Also, efforts by one physicist there to turn data from the collider into sound. Make sure you've got your headphones on for that one. And we'd also love to hear what you think of the podcast. Tell us what you'd like to hear. Send an email to sciencepodcast@npr.org. But first this week, a medical journal in the UK says the British doctor who became famous for linking autism to a childhood vaccine committed scientific fraud. The allegation involves a 1998 study by Andrew Wakefield that gained worldwide attention but has since been widely and repeatedly discredited. Now, an investigation by the British Medical Journal has concluded that Wakefield altered or fabricated basic information about the children in his study. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
The new findings come from Brian Deer, a journalist in the UK who has been debunking Wakefield's claims for 7 years now. Many scientists questioned the original study when it was published in the journal The Lancet. Eventually, Wakefield's co-authors disavowed the study and the journal retracted it. And last year, Wakefield lost his medical license. The disciplinary hearing leading up to that made public medical records on the 12 children in his study. Deer has now compared those records with Wakefield's claims and found that almost nothing checked out.
3 out of 9 cases, he said, had regressive autism, didn't have autism diagnosis at all. Where he said children had problems developing within days of vaccination, we find either that the children had developed their problems before vaccination or alternatively months after vaccination. Where he said all the children had an inflammatory bowel disease, we were able to get at the actual hospital records and show that they did not diagnose any inflammatory bowel disease.
Deer says editors at the British Medical Journal checked the records on their own before publishing his investigation and an accompanying editorial.
They satisfied themselves that what I was saying was accurate, and on that basis adjudicated that this was willful fraud.
Deer's findings are no surprise to people who've been following the Wakefield case. Paul Offit is a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a champion of childhood vaccination.
I don't think anything's new here. Even the revelation, quote-unquote, that he had altered clinical data to fit his hypothesis is not new. I think what we've learned from this is that this was not a scientist.
Instead, Offit says, Wakefield was a man with a very strong belief, which probably helped him influence people in a way that did great harm. Offit says Wakefield's public comments helped cause vaccination rates in the UK to decline sharply. The result, he says, is that hundreds of kids have been hospitalized for things like measles and whooping cough. 4 have died.
And so basically that paper killed 4 children. And who's responsible? I mean, you can argue Wakefield certainly was responsible, but so was the editor of that journal, and so was the media that sort of ravenously followed that story as if it was a fact when clearly it was wrong. And I think as a public health and scientific community, we didn't stand up hard and strong enough to prevent that.
Wakefield's ideas tapped into many people's distrust of drug companies and the government, along with their desire to protect children. David Ropeek is an instructor at Harvard and the author of a book about why we tend to focus on certain risks while ignoring others. Ropeek says more revelations about Wakefield aren't likely to make the fear of vaccines go away. But he says something else eventually will.
As more and more and more people get measles and kids die, which is happening around the world, eventually the threat of the disease will come back and surmount our fear of the vaccines.
In the meantime, Andrew Wakefield says in a statement that he continues to stand behind his 1998 study. John Hamilton, NPR News.
When your date at the movie starts crying, it may be having an effect on you even if you can't see the tears. That's the conclusion of a team of Israeli scientists in a report that came out this week. NPR's Joe Palka has more.
You don't have to be a psychologist to know that tears can have a powerful effect. You see someone cry, and anger tends to turn to compassion. But a group of Israeli scientists wondered if the effect was strictly visual. In other words, might there be some chemical in human tears that was responsible for that urge to care for someone? So they advertised for males or females willing to donate tears.
We got mainly female donors.
Idan Fruman is a biochemist at the Weizmann Institute for Science in Rehovot. He and his colleagues decided to see whether just smelling a woman's tears had a measurable effect on men. So they had their female tear donors watch sad movies. Then they took a few drops of a woman's tears and had men sniff them to see if the tears had any recognizable smell.
And they don't.
Even though they didn't smell anything, Fruman and his colleagues still asked their subjects to fill out a questionnaire.
One of the questions in the questionnaire was, what is the state of sexual arousal of the specific subject in this specific moment? And to our amazement, we saw that drop in arousal.
That prompted them to do a bunch more studies, and the findings were consistent. Testosterone levels went down, and brain areas involved in sexual arousal were quiet after men sniffed a woman's tears. None of those changes occurred when men sniffed salty water that had been dribbled down a woman's cheek. As they report in the journal Science, Fruman and his colleagues say there must be some chemical in human tears causing this effect. Thomas Cleland is a psychologist at Cornell University.
It's probably the best study yet showing that chemical communication between humans is a reality.
Cleland says it shouldn't be surprising that humans can communicate with chemical signals. Animals clearly do it. It's just been hard to prove for humans. But psychologist James Cherry of Boston University says while the Israeli study convinces him that there is some chemical signal, you can't say it's only in tears from the Israeli experiments.
Certainly there are effects, but whatever substance or substances that may be there could be found in a lot of places. We just don't know that.
Cherry says the chemical could be in sweat or saliva. Psychologist Ad Vinkerhoets of Tilburg University in the Netherlands has also been studying human tears. He says women's tears may reduce male testosterone and sexual arousal, but that's not the main effect.
It's my hypothesis that tears has an effect not primarily on testosterone, but on oxytocin.
Vinkerhoets says oxytocin is a hormone that promotes social bonding and caregiving. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
About a third of the material that gushed into the ocean from the BP blowout wasn't oil. It was natural gas. Scientists have been trying to figure out what happened to all of that carbon-rich material, especially whether it disrupted the Gulf's ecosystems. A new study concludes that it was gobbled up rapidly by bacteria and is already gone. NPR's Richard Harris says this conclusion is stirring a bit of controversy.
While most of the world was focusing on the frightening oil slick spreading across the Gulf of Mexico, John Kessler from Texas A&M University was wondering what was happening to all the methane gas that bubbled out of BP's Macondo well. It had the potential, at least, to deplete oxygen that fish and shrimp need. He was on an early scientific expedition to the Gulf.
We were first out in the middle of June, and it was at that time where we were noticing very large concentrations of methane in the deep ocean.
The methane didn't seem to be bubbling to the surface, and undersea bacteria were eating it, but very slowly.
This wasn't terribly surprising because most of the places we normally study are fairly active natural methane seeps around the planet. And even in those natural environments, the rate at which methane decomposes is fairly slow as well.
So Kessler, along with many other marine scientists, figured that methane from the blowout would persist in the deep ocean for many years. He and some colleagues returned to the Gulf in August, expecting to find plenty of methane still out there.
What we were met with was an entirely different story.
They took more than 200 water samples and found essentially no excess methane. Two things could have happened to it.
Did methane itself just dilute out, or was it consumed by some of the indigenous bacteria that are in the water?
There are bacteria in the Gulf of Mexico known for their ability to gobble up methane. And sure enough, Kessler and his colleagues found those bacteria in abundance. They also looked at oxygen levels, because these bacteria consume oxygen when they eat methane. And Kessler and his colleagues report in Science magazine that oxygen was also depleted in the deep water layer where they had originally found the methane.
All of that oxygen lost could only be explained by a complete consumption of the methane.
So Kessler's paper concludes that in just 120 days, bacteria basically gobbled up all of this methane and turned it into carbon dioxide and organic carbon. Ian McDonald at Florida State University, for one, is not so sure.
I'm not totally convinced by the data that they present here.
For one thing, it seems odd that the methane-eating bacteria usually do their work quite slowly around natural methane seeps, but became super speedy around the oil well. And McDonald says nobody really managed to trace the deep undersea currents, which could have carried away the methane.
It's possible that there was enough flow, enough current movement, water movement, through this region that what we're looking at is not so much the disappearance of gas due to consumption by the microbes, but simply by mixing.
Further tests of the Gulf water can help resolve this puzzle. If bacteria did indeed eat up the oil, they should have left behind telltale traces of ancient carbon from these fossil fuels. What we're witnessing here, McDonald says, is science in progress, so no single study is likely to provide a definitive answer.
And the exciting thing about the science that's happening here is that there are alternative ideas, and there are plausible alternative ideas being put forward by very respectable and capable people, and I think this is going to teach us a lot about this giant experiment and how the ocean works.
McDonald and Kessler both agree that the methane findings are reassuring. Whatever happened to the methane, it does not seem to have caused obvious damage to the economically valuable ecosystems near the surface or near the shore in the Gulf of Mexico. Richard Harris, NPR News.
This year, the world's largest science experiment roared to life. Deep beneath the French-Swiss border, the Large Hadron Collider has spent the year accelerating subatomic particles to near the speed of light and smashing them together. These collisions are being used to push the theories of physics to their limits. Jeff Brumfield traveled to the collider in Switzerland and filed this report.
It's hard to explain how much the Large Hadron Collider means to physicists, but you get a sense of it when you speak to Srini Rajagopalan. He works on a giant underground detector that records what's produced in the collisions. It's called ATLAS.
I've been working in ATLAS since 1996. I was down in that pit when it was completely empty, and it was wonderful. It was huge. I have watched the detector being built. I was involved in the research and development, then for the production, then the testing, putting the whole thing together.
Thousands of researchers like him have devoted the best years of their lives to getting the LHC and its detectors up and running. They switched on with great fanfare in 2008. Collisions were just days away when a faulty connection triggered an explosion in the machine's liquid helium coolant. It was a devastating accident. Though Stephen Goldfarb, another researcher on ATLAS, puts the best face on it he can.
As a lesson to the world, we arranged for the LHC to have a small explosion so that they could learn about how what happens when liquid helium expands.
That sounds like spin to me.
Yeah, it's spin. I agree. We didn't really want this to happen, and it set us back for a good year or so.
This year, the LHC finally got going, and that means researchers can finally start looking for new particles. At the top of their list is one called the Higgs. Researchers think the Higgs explains the masses of all the other particles. Its discovery would be a major find, and everyone's excited. Goldfarb's even got a song.
We got the LHC running our ATLAS, you're my home. The LHC's running our ATLAS, you're my home. I've been working all night out at point one, looking for the Higgs, that son of a gun. The LHC's running our ATLAS, you're my home. I'm not going to keep going. I could go forever.
Think of the LHC as an underground racetrack. Instead of cars, the machine uses protons, the positive particles at the center of atoms. Two streams of protons travel in opposite directions around the 17-mile ring and collide inside of four detectors the size of buildings. David Francis is another researcher working on ATLAS.
It's a bit harsh, this comparison, but imagine two cars crashing and each car's got passengers in. They crash into each other and bits fly everywhere, right? And then your job is to identify what the cars were beforehand and how many passengers were in each car.
Except it's more than just the contents of the cars. Smashing protons together actually makes new particles. Stephen Goldfarb says turning on the collider is a bit like turning on the Hubble Space Telescope.
When the Hubble turned on and looked out into space, they had some ideas what they were going to see, but they also didn't know. And that's probably the coolest part of what we do. Instead of looking out, we're looking in, and we're looking for new things.
The LHC produces hundreds of millions of collisions each second. Sorting through all those collisions to find something like the Higgs requires a lot of computers. David Francis takes me inside a two-story building above the ATLAS detector.
So if you're looking just down the aisle here, you see 19 racks, 19 cabinets and computers with 31 computers in a rack.
The interesting collisions get recorded to disk. Even throwing away most of them, researchers still end up with a lot of data.
So I think if you do the numbers, you end up with a pile of DVDs per year, which is higher than the Eiffel Tower in Paris, something like that.
Once researchers have that data, they can start to look for the Higgs. But that's not the only thing they're looking for. Joe Incandela is hoping they'll find a mysterious kind of matter called dark matter. He works at the CMS detector, which is 5 miles away from ATLAS on the opposite side of the ring.
In fact, our galaxy is loaded with this dark matter, but we have no idea what it is. It's very likely to be heavy stuff that we could produce at the LHC. All the theories indicate there's a good chance we produce it.
That's just the start of a list that gets progressively more sci-fi. The machine will study antimatter. It will probe milliseconds after the Big Bang. It could also turn up extra dimensions of space, microscopic black holes, or something nobody's even thought of yet. So far, researchers haven't seen too much new, but with an Eiffel Tower's worth of data each year, they're optimistic. After 15 years of waiting, Srini Rajagopalan says everyone's getting down to business.
There are a lot of teams of people looking for signs of new physics. Ah, finally, we have data. This is what we've been looking for, waiting for such a long time.
We got the LHC running now, Atlas, you're mine.
The LHC is starting to hum. Researchers may be singing the blues, but they feel good. For NPR News, I'm Jeff Brumfield.
It's our friends at 2 and 5 and 8. They might find the hits, they're going to be too late. The LHC is running now, Atlas, you're mine.
Now, as Jeff just mentioned, researchers at the Large Hadron Collider are challenged by a mountain of data. But one researcher at the LHC has come up with a novel way to sift through and analyze the data: sound. And in the process, she's accomplishing another goal, getting non-scientists to care. Lily Asquith is a physicist who until recently worked at the Large Hadron Collider. She lives and breathes subatomic particles.
I suppose we spend a lot of time thinking about these particles, and so you do tend to personify things that you think about a lot.
She gives them personalities, colors, and sounds.
I think electrons perhaps sound like a glockenspiel to me.
Lily and other researchers at the LHC were searching for the Higgs boson, the subatomic particle that scientists say gives everything in the universe mass. In the process of this search, the LHC generates just a massive amount of information. More than 40 million pieces of data every second, and that's just from one of the four main detectors in the deep underground complex. So Lily was trying to figure out a new way to understand and sort through all this data. The LHC currently produces images as an output from the data, beautiful, colorful images, sprays of particles in different directions.
And it's quite easy to step from there, really, to consider that there could be some kind of sound associated with these things.
She thought about a heart monitor in a hospital, like this one, how it turns the electrical data from your heart into sound.
You don't have to watch the monitor because you can hear it without making any effort. Just this steady beep, you can quite easily detect if it starts going quicker or stops even for a second.
And she wondered, what would it be like to use music composition software to turn data from the collider into sound? She fed in a sample of the LHC data, just three columns of numbers.
So we'll map, for example, the first column of numbers, which may be a distance, to time, and we may map the second column of numbers to pitch, and the third, perhaps, to volume.
What she got isn't quite music. Something more out of this world. So what does it all mean? Well, right now, Lily Asquith says the sounds don't tell scientists very much, but she hopes that in the future, it could help them understand the data in new ways. She says that in certain situations, it's much easier to use your ears than your eyes, particularly with something that's changing over time. But the project is doing something else, making what's going on at the collider accessible and interesting to people without PhDs. That includes many of Lily's friends who are musicians. They're really interested in and even fascinated by what's going on there. But she says they get a frightened look on their face when she brings up the hard science.
I just think that's unnecessary. That it frightens people. It should be something that everyone should enjoy.
Andrew Prince, NPR News, Washington. That's all for this week's On Science podcast. We'll bring you more stories and conversations from the Science Desk next week. In the meantime, send us an email at sciencepodcast@npr.org and give us some feedback. Have a great week.